The Sons of Brutus and the Mounds of London. And this is taken from E.O. Gordon's Prehistoric London, Its Mounds and Circles. Brutus was succeeded in Logria by his eldest son Locrinus, in Albion by his second son Alban, and in Cambria by his youngest son Camber. The portion of Britain assigned to Tronius, the valiant companion of Brutus, was the western Carron, or promontory, extending from Torbay to the Land's End, part of which is now known as Cornwall. From the Carron, Tronius changed his name into Carron, or Corineus. The dukedom of Cornwall, thus founded, was a dukedom royal. That is, the duke within it exercised the same prerogatives as the kings of Logria, Cambria, and Albion did within their territories. Next to these crowns, it is the oldest title in Britain. Spenser alludes to this naming of Cornwall in The Faery Queen. Quote, "In meed of these great conquests by them got, Corineus had that province utmost west, to him assigned for his worthy lot, which of his name and memorable guest he called Cornwall." Close quote. The tradition that a race of giants dwelt in Cornwall, Drayton quaintly alludes to in his Polyolbion. After a terrible struggle, the Trojans got the upper hand and killed all their assailants, except their leader, Gogmagog, who was preserved for combat with Corineus, who, holding it a diversion to encounter giants, met him on a spot pointed out to this day on Plymouth Hoe. Gogmagog broke three of his opponent's ribs, and this so enraged Corineus that, taking the giant upon his shoulders, he ran with him to the shore, and getting upon the top of a high rock, hurled the savage monster into the sea. The struggle between these mighty men of valour was recorded as late as Queen Elizabeth's time by what Carew calls the portraiture of two men with clubs in their hands, cutting the turf, the one bigger, the other lesser, whom they term Gogmagog and Corineus, intimating the wrestling to have been between these two champions and the steep rocky cliff affording aptitude for such a cast. Carew considers that the great activity of Devon and Cornishmen in the faculty of wrestling seems to derive them a special pedigree from that grand wrestler, Corineus. Spenser, in his Faery Queen, where he records the early history of Britain, refers to the conflict of Brutus and Corineus with the giants. Quote, "But ere he had established his throne, and spread the empire to the utmost shore, he fought great battles with his savage foes, in which he defeated evermore, and many giants left on groaning floor, that well can witness yet unto this day, the western who, besprinkled with the gore of mighty Gogmagog, whom in stout play Corineus conquered and cruelly did slay." The Plymouth Corporation records confirm the recutting and renewal of these figures as early as 1494. It was only when the citadel was erected in 1671 that this interesting monument was destroyed. The story of Jack the Giant Killer is said to have had its origin in the combat of Corineus with the Cornish giant, and there seems little reason to doubt the tradition that the two gigantic figures in the Guildhall of the City of London, popularly called Gog and Magog, really represent Corineus and Gogmagog. And now, in the light gathered from similar mounds in other parts of Britain, we will pass on to a more detailed examination of the prehistoric mounds that stood around about the Porth of Llandin, or the Lindin, the Lake City, the Car Troia of Brutus, the London or Londinian of the Romans. Upon the two natural eminences of the Llandin and the Penton, The eyes of Brutus must have rested when he made choice of the Cymric Car for his capital, the two smaller artificial mounds of the Bryn Gwyn and the Tot Hill may have been erected by the Trojan king as trade increased under his rule. It is conceivable that in the foreknowledge of the Creator, the two high places commanding the marshes east, west and south may have been predestined to be used in the service of the Lord of Hosts, as holy hills from whose summits the astronomer priests in the dawn of civilization might study the heavens that declare the glory of God and the firmament that showeth his handiwork, and by heliograph, semaphore or beacon light signal the time and the seasons, the result of their observations for the daily direction of the lives of the traders and seafaring population of the port. History has proved the wisdom of Brutus's choice of what appeared a very unpromising district for a capital, which has held its own and won its way to the foremost place as the capital of the British Empire and the greatest city in the world. The Llandin, Parliament Hill, is the largest, loftiest and most imposing of the four prehistoric gorsets of great seats of the metropolis. Standing on a spur of the northern heights, in an amphitheatre of wooded hills midway between Hampstead and Highgate, from its site and surroundings, the sacred eminence retains somewhat of its original dignity as a high place of worship. The structure of the hill is London clay at its base, gradually changing to a sandy loam. The central boss would appear to have been sculptured from the highest layer, since there is a circular terrace still distinct. Half a century ago, the sighting lines, somewhat similar to those on Silbury Hill, and graded slopes were to be traced, but a pathway over the summit and trees planted on the sides have destroyed the original contour. A vestige of the trench remains, which in Cymric times encircled the base, but the spring has been diverted by the LCC and now forms a series of ponds where bathing and boating may be enjoyed by the general public. Symbolic, as are all our prehistoric mounds, of the earth rising out of the sea, a British gorsed may always be known by its symbolic trench. Parliament Hill carries on its Celtic traditions as a place of assembly to this day. On the northeastern slope is a stone monument on which an inscription states that here public speaking is allowed. The numerous assemblies, religious and political, which from time immemorial have been held either on the mound itself or on Parliament Fields at its base, is an interesting survival of a national custom. The Llandin has been called the Areopagus of Britain from the tradition that St. Paul preached from the summit. On this account, the apostle became the patron saint of London, and his emblem, the Sword of Martyrdom, incorporated in the arms of the city, in the same way as St. Peter became the patron saint of Chartres from the tradition that this apostle preached in the Grotto des Druids, a Druidic rock temple, the actual foundations of the oldest cathedral in France. What is more likely if, as history tells us, St. Paul's friends were the children of King Caractacus, then they should take measures for the conversion of their native land. And the great love St. Paul had for his peculiar mission to the Gentile world would not have allowed him to overlook the claims of such an important city as the Colonia Augusta of the Roman writers. The Roman historian Tacitus, writing in AD 61, describes Londinium as famous for its vast number of merchants who resorted to it, for its widely extended commerce, and for the abundance of every species of commodity which it could supply. Strabo speaks of British merchants as bringing to the Seine and the Rhine shiploads of corn and cattle, iron, hides, slaves and dogs, and taking back brass, ivory, amber ornaments and vessels of glass, and that the port was considered by the Romans as the metropolis of Britain is further established by the fact of its being the residence of the Vicar of Britain. The abode of such an officer clearly marks London to have been a seat of government, of justice, and of the administration of the finances, which consequently contributed to its extent, its magnificence, and its wealth. As early as the year AD 359, 800 vessels were employed for the conveyance and exportation of corn only, says Brayley in his Londinium. The prehistoric burial ground of the leaders of pre-Roman times was close around Parliament Hill, reminding us of the cemetery around about Silbury. Several barrows remain to this day, notably Primrose Hill and Barrow Hill, the site today of a reservoir. Other tumuli have been levelled and all trace of them is lost. A bird's-eye view of the two cities, one in Britain and one in Asia Minor, would offer a general resemblance, and in the case of the latter, the tombs bear the names of the heroes of the Trojan War, as every tourist will remember. At Highgate, a memorial of the national religion survives in the place names of the Grove and Bishop's Wood, situated on high ground, on the fringe of the forest that in Cymric times framed the Gorset, the Grove commands a view of both Parliament Hill and the Penton, and was the probable site of the Druidic College, where dwelt the ministers of law and order, the Druids. Bishopswood, mainly consisting of oak trees, lies at the foot of a steep descent westward of the Grove, and is so called from the fact that it has formed from time immemorial part of the endowment of the bishopric of London. There is documentary evidence of the Emperor Constantine having bestowed the royal demesnes hereabouts and a portion of the forest on the Diocese of London, together with the Gorsed lands of King Cole's Castle and Cunobeline's royal city of Camulodunum. Colchester, being at that time in the Diocese of London. Constantine thus appears to have followed in the footsteps of his predecessors, Arviragus at Glastonbury and Lucius at Winchester, in thus transferring the druidic emoluments of the Gorseds to the maintenance of the Christian faith, now established as the national religion. In Triad number 3, paragraph 62, special mention is made of the Emperor Constantine. He is, according to the triad, the first of the emperors to extend his royal patronage to those who assembled together in the faith of Christ. It is noteworthy this mention is connected with the three archbishops of the island of Britain. At the foot of Parliament Hill is Gospel Oak Station, a name which connects the Druidic with the Christian religion and links British and Saxon customs. One of the first acts of Edward the Confessor after his coronation at Winchester was to renew the Charter of Rights to the citizens of London, seated under the sacred oak of the Druids. The Penton, and pen signifies in Celtic a hill rounded like a head, is a natural height about halfway between the Llandan and the Bren Gwyn. The new river reservoir now occupies the site of the prehistoric sanctuary, and its massive masonry and earthworks have completely obliterated all traces of the original circular contour of the ton or sacred mound. Approached by mean streets, nothing could well be more dismal and depressing than the appearance of this prehistoric Gorsed as we see it today. It is difficult even to imagine it as depicted by Hollar, still less as the spot where, in Elizabethan times, Gerard the Herbalist mentions he found the white saxifrage growing in abundance. But if the beautiful greensward has disappeared and the Penton has lost its rural aspect, there is the same far-stretching panoramic view to be seen as in British times, however much it may differ in detail. It is well worth a pilgrimage, if only to appreciate the magnificent sight of the Holy Hill and to gaze on the splendour of the dim, rich city spread out at our feet with its mysterious medley of spires, domes and palaces dominated by St. Paul's, gleaming from out the mist like some beautiful vision. No site could have better realised in its day the regulations laid down by Ayad Mar, the founder of the Druidic Order, viz. That a Gorsed of the Bards of Britain must be held on a green spot in a conspicuous place in full view and hearing of country and aristocracy in the face of the sun, the eye of light under the expansive freedom of the sky that all may see and hear. Commanding both the car and the port, it is probable that the summit of the Penton was crowned by a stone circle, probably oriented to the May sunrise, the new year of the ancients, like so many of the existing Cornish circles. We owe to Sir Norman Lockyer the knowledge that the majority of circles were thus oriented. A very perfect example of one of these Gorseds may be seen at Boscawenon, not far from the Land's End. Near the centre of the 19 standing stones is a monolith 8 feet out of the ground, which inclines to the northeast. One of the stones is a block of quartz 4 feet high, obviously placed in a post of honour. As a matter of fact, from it, the May sun was seen to rise over the index stone in the centre of the circle. This remarkable circle is referred to in a Welsh triad. Quote, "The three conventions of perfect song of the Isle of Britain, the convention of Boscawen in Donegal, the convention of Carcharodhug in Clogria, and the convention of Bren Gwydion in Cymru." It is suggested that Donegal is the kingdom of Damnonium, and that Boscawen is Boscawenon. Carcharodhug is the hill of Caractacus in Salop, and Bren Gwydion is in Anglesey. That the circle of Boscawenon was the centre of a large population in Druidic times is certain from the numerous remains of British dwellings in the immediate neighbourhood. Many of the domed stone roofs were in perfect condition until a few years ago, when, one by one, they were wantonly destroyed by idle youths on Sunday afternoons, we were told by the farmer. And that this district, in the extreme west of Cornwall, was one of the headquarters of Druidical worship is shown by the remains of what appear to have been some of the finest and most elaborately constructed circles in the country, judging from Sir Norman Lockyer's account of Batalloch, now completely destroyed by the erection on the site of the offices of the famous copper mine. At Boscawenon, probably, the bards would assemble from all parts of the country for a convention of perfect song or an Eisteddfod. But to return to the Penton, it is probable that this circle was the principal observatory of Car Troia from the fact that within a few yards of the present reservoir, which is built on the actual summit, there is a well of unknown antiquity under Sadler's Wells Theatre, lined with masonry of ancient date, throughout its entire depth, similar to the prehistoric wells we have already mentioned on the Windsor Table Mound, on the Wallingford Mound, and the well used by the first Astronomer Royal at Greenwich. Our present knowledge does not enable us to do more than call the reader's attention to the existence of these telescope wells, as they have been called, either pierced in the side of the Gorsed, or as in the case of the Bren Gwydion and the Oxford Mounds, the well is now at the base of what may have been originally a shaft or funnel-shaped opening. The famous Holy Well in Dean's Yard, Westminster, referred to by Dean Stanley, may very possibly, nay, probably was, a druidic well connected with the astronomical observations of the circle on Thorney and the Tothill. That wells were used by the ancient astronomers, we learn from Strabo, the Greek geographer. Describing his travels in Egypt, he says, Ancien is a well which indicates the summer solstice, because these places lie under the tropical circle. For on proceeding from the places in our country in Greece, I mean, the sun is there first overhead, and occasions the gnomons to be vertical shadows at noon, when the sun is vertical to us. It must necessarily cast its rays down wells, however deep they may be, to the water, for we ourselves stand in a perpendicular posture, and wells are dug perpendicularly to the surface. Pliny and Arrian both mention this well, and Aristophanes, a distinguished member of the science school of Alexandria, accepting the proof that Cyrene was under the Tropic of Cancer, made use of the fact in computing the circumference of the Earth. Modern astronomers have found this method of making daylight observation so reliable that at the Potsdam and Wilson observatories, similar wells to those used by the ancients have been made, fixed with mirrors. The old saying, truth lies at the bottom of a well, may probably be traced to the use of these wells in Druidic times. In the interior of the Pentan is a cave known as Merlin's Cave, which, so late as the 18th century, when Islington Spa was a fashionable health resort and royalty came to enjoy the prospect and partake of syllabubs, appears to have been a kind of show place. An underground passage at the bottom of the hill led to the cave, the entrance to which, in the cellars of Merlin's Cave Tavern, has only recently been bricked up, the passage being considered no longer safe. Whatever may be the value of the tradition connecting this cave with the astronomer druid of King Arthur's court, it is not inherently improbable that he who was the most famous man of all those times, Merlin, who knew the range of all their arts, had built the king his havens, ships and halls, was also bard, and knew the starry heavens. The people called him wizard. It is not inherently improbable that he should have carried on his astronomical studies in the neighbourhood of the ancient well on the Pentan. Merlin's cave may have been subsequently used as a session house, from the example of the cave at the base of the Gorset at Oxford. Many a solar and lunar festival has probably been celebrated upon the summit of the Pentan, in which British kings have played their part. The presence of the sovereign appears to have been usual on these occasions of national rejoicing. We gather from the traditions and usages of the Druidic order that after the sacrifices had been offered by the priests within the precincts of the circle, the Gorsed procession was formed and preceded by bards and trumpeters and escorted by the druids, the ministers of the sanctuary, the monarch in his chariot, accompanied by his aiders in council, proceeded to the Llandin, the great seat or throne of the monarch, where the Gorsed was solemnized in all the dignity of its symbolic ritual on the Hill of Conference, familiar to us as Parliament Hill. The memory of the old road by which the procession wended its way to the place of assembly survives in the name of Maiden Lane, a railway station not far from Pentan,